everybody, and welcome in to another True Crime Tuesday, the best in true crime talk radio. I'm Tim Dennis. You know, we've gotten such great guests lately, Tuesday after Tuesday after Tuesday, and today is no exception. I'm really excited to talk to today's guests. You know, when we talk about the mafia, you automatically assume it's someone in Italy. I mean, at least I do. I love The Godfather. I love Goodfellas. I love all those movies. One of the most dangerous mafias out there, and one of the mafias that absolutely chills me to the bone, are stories of the Russian mafia. And there's a story out there that intrigued me, that I wanted to get down to the business of, and the guest that I'm going to bring on today has a name that you may think is a pseudonym. It's not. Our guest today is John Christmas. John Christmas was working in a Latvia bank, and we're going to find out more about that, when he discovered corruption at its deepest levels in this Latvia bank. And I'm not going to go any further. We're just going to bring him on and find out his story. Ladies and gentlemen, let's welcome to True Crime Tuesday, John Christmas. John, good morning, good evening, whatever this is. Welcome to True Crime Tuesday. It's my pleasure to bring you aboard.
Hello, Tim. Thank you for inviting me. I'm happy to be part of the program.
You know, when we get, I should start out with stereotypes right away, and then we'll jump into your story. When we get stereotypes of the Russian mafia, you get the cold-hearted, cold-blooded, deep-voiced, kind of, you know, I guess, thick, heavy Russian mobster. Can you break any of those stereotypes for us? What was your experience? I'm going to save that question.
I can say that there are things about the Russian mafia that Americans can never understand. And one of them, for example, is the total cooperation between the mafia and law enforcement or intelligence, that the mafia is part of the government, or the government is part of the mafia, or they operate as the same entity. Now, the way that that I got into all of this, I mean, this is for the true story that inspired the fictional story, which is in my novel KGB Banker, which I co-authored with William Burton McCormick. The way I got into all of this inadvertently is I got recruited to work for a bank. And they didn't tell me we are all crooks here. They recruited me saying that our bank is totally legit. We're audited by Big Four auditors. We have ratings from the top ratings agencies. We're regulated by a European Union regulator. All of this was the message, that everything is clean here. But then, as I was convincing Western partners of this bank of how clean we were, I was attending internal meetings when I was learning all sorts of disturbing stuff about what was really going on there was different from what the message was. But this use of front people is something that the Russians are masters of, where, okay, if they want someone from the bank to go talk to another Western bank, who should they choose? Well, they shouldn't choose a Russian person to go talk to the other bank. They should choose a Western person to go talk to the other bank to make the other bank comfortable that everything is legit. So the use of front people on several different levels was part of what I encountered. And then also later, the disappointment of the merger between organized crime and the government officials. And the story is set in Latvia, but this is about Russia, because this is a bank that was connected with the Russian government. However, it's in Latvia because it's an offshore bank used by the Kremlin.
Okay, let's rewind a little bit. I want to find out a little bit about you first and how you run into this job. Give us a little bit of a taste of life before this particular job. What were you doing before this job?
Well, I was a banker in the United States, so I had banking experience already, and I'm educated in the United States. I grew up in the United States. I got this job offer to be the Western relationship person for the largest bank in Latvia. I am partly Latvian myself. This is something that we've put into the fictional novel, because the character, the main character, is based on me, that it's a person from Chicago who's partly Latvian who gets recruited to work for this bank. I mean, from there on, it's fiction, but it's anyway, that's my story. Mm-hmm. So I thought I was going to work for this legitimate bank when I went there and was very disappointed by the way things actually turned out.
Now, when, because I'm curious, it runs through my mind, and I'm sure it's running through the listener's mind as well. As an American banker, do you put feelers out there to work for an international corporation, or is it something where you get recruited? I mean, I know in my business, when it comes to radio or podcasting, when I want to go work, let's say on the East Coast or the West Coast, I start looking for jobs there automatically. And I understand you have Latvian heritage, and you're a Chicago boy. I'm a Minnesota boy. So let's say, you know, I've got French heritage. I've got Eastern Europe. I actually have Eastern European heritage as well. If I wanted to go work over in Europe, well, I would start to seek out, you know, radio stations over there. Or if I wanted to take the podcast over there, I would start looking at, you know, places and what the Wi-Fi, I guess, is over there. How do you go about that? Is it a two-way street? Explain to me how you end up over in Latvia.
Well, so because I have partly Latvian heritage, I visited Latvia several times before I started working for this bank. And I met the people from this bank through the American Chamber of Commerce in Latvia. So it was through an American connection. And then having met these people, they said they're looking for Western people who would like to spread the good news about how this bank is completely clean and has proper corporate governance and anti-money laundering controls and so forth. But I actually met them at a American Chamber of Commerce event in Latvia.
And when you meet with them, obviously, it doesn't seem like anything is awry or anything is fishy or anything like that. Do you do research on the firm when you first start thinking about the job?
Well, there were rumors that this bank was the mafia. And during my interviews with them, they were trying to convince me this is not true. And they had an American already working there. They also had an Irish woman also working there. And I met both of them, and both of them were assuring me that they thought everything was okay at the bank. The bank was audited and with ratings that were all from Western countries, I mean, from the big firms. So the message to me was that, look, everything here is clean. Anything you hear about us being the mafia is a rumor or something that already got cleaned up a long time ago. That was the message. So then this complex transformation goes on. I mean, the other people in other organizations in Latvia who come across the same thing, they start off working there and they think everything is normal. And then you start to come across strange things, like during meetings and all, where things come up that would not come up, for example, at the meetings in the banks I worked for in the United States. I mean, in this case, it was making large loans, which were booked fraudulently and were going to people who were known to be criminals. I mean, this is the thing. And I've been to loan committee meetings in the United States, and I never heard anybody discussing this.
Walk me through, if you will, because so you get an obvious tell, like a loan to a suspected, at this point, suspected criminal. Obviously, you're not going to shout it to the rooftop to anybody within the bank. I mean, that's certain suicide. But what's your first move when you hear something like this? I mean, obviously, you're alarmed, but you don't want to give up the job either or your life. What's your first move when you hear something like that?
Well, what I did is I wrote down a list of information. By the time I felt that I had an abundance of information, way more than necessary to prove that the bank was fraudulent, I gave the money to the auditor. And I'm not going to name the auditor because, in fact, sure, I'm not going to name any particular people or companies in this talk. But anyway, I gave the information to the auditor, and I thought the auditor's reaction was going to be to pull their audit opinion immediately. And I left the country as well. And the fact that they chose not to do that is startling. This is, in fact, a common thing with other frauds in Latvia and Russia and Ukraine, where we found that the Western auditors, have been signing off on all sorts of audit opinions for all sorts of mafia companies with fake financial statements. And they seem to take no responsibility for this, or nobody puts responsibility on them. But there have been bank after bank after bank in Russia and Ukraine and in Latvia as well, where the people who control the bank, they make loans of all the depositor money to themselves. And then one day they say, surprise, they're not paying back the depositors and the government has to pay them back.
So that's why the Western auditor would sign off on it. I'm trying to, as someone who's not savvy in banking, why would you so freely sign off on something like that if you're a Western auditor?
I suppose the problem with the auditing, the whole auditing profession right now, is it's so hard to prove that any auditor has purposely done something that they feel no risk from it. So if the bank makes a huge loan to some offshore company where it's a fake loan and they're not intending to get the money back and it actually was embezzlement or a payoff, if you structure that so it looks like a normal loan, then the auditor can sign off on it as if it is a normal loan. And maybe the auditor suspects or knows that it's not a normal loan, but you can't really prove that the auditor knew this. Again, it's been not only with the bank where I work, but with other banks as well. I suppose that it's just really hard to prove that a loan is fake if it's crafted, you know, in such a way that it looks like a real loan.
Understandable. So let me ask you this, John. And then I want to find out some individual stories or examples of different types of corruption within the bank. If I'm part of a governmental agency within Latvia and it's outside of Russia, mind you, there's no such thing at this time. I take it as the Soviet Union, correct? You're working outside of that organization. It's just an affiliation of the different countries, correct?
Well, I mean, as far as the Soviet Union, the collapse of the Soviet Union did not really collapse as much as we think it did. Okay. And in certain countries, like in Russia and Latvia, the former KGB became the mafia. And the prosecutors were part of the system, because in the Soviet times, the KGB would tell the prosecutors who to prosecute and who not to prosecute. When the Soviet Union broke up, the prosecutors remained the same people. So the prosecutors in Russia and the prosecutors in Latvia were the same people they were before, and they were still reporting to the same people they were before. And those people used to be the KGB, and now they're the mafia.
So really, it's just flipping hats. It's turning a black hat to a white hat and continuing business.
Sure.
Okay.
And now I can get into the big connection with this bank, which is verifiable, so I can name an organization. There was a mafia in the early days of the rise of Vladimir Putin. The mafia was called Tambovskaya, and it was based in St. Petersburg. There was a big investigation and trial in Spain some years ago, because some of the guys had houses in Mallorca. I don't know if you've been to Mallorca, but it's a lovely place. Mm-hmm. And some of the Russian guys from Tambovskaya had houses there. Now, in that investigation, the Spanish government, there is documentation from the trial. So this is from the Spanish justice system, tied my bank to that mafia, that my bank was processing the money for that mafia, which was the Tambovskaya mafia, which was the most dangerous in Russia. Not only that, but in fact, some argue is the government of Russia today.
So the ties were clearly made in that Spanish court.
Yes, and it's about all sorts of stuff. It's about narcotics trafficking. It's about weapons trafficking. It's about very serious criminal activity, which seems to be tied to the Russian government, because in that trial as well, they were monitoring the telephones of certain people. The people were calling top people in the Russian government. I mean, the mafia guys were calling the top people in the Russian government to coordinate their activities together. So the result of the trial seemed to be that there is a union in Russia between the government and between this mafia.
Was there an effort to try and bring that from a Spanish court to a world court in order to go after the government of Russia?
Well, I wish there would be more efforts. There are certain people who were actually in prison. There were some people in Spain at the time this was all released who were arrested. Some of the people who are high officials in Russia and don't go out of Russia are not going to get arrested. As to what the rest of the world is doing, I'm not sure. I mean, there are for sure people who could be prosecuted in many countries. I mean, the United States and the other European countries could do something. One speculation about Spain is that Russia is very vindictive about people who go after their mafia. And there was unrest in the Catalonia region of Spain, which followed this Tambovskaya mafia trial. And there are theories that Russia actually incited the violence, that Russia actually incited the separatists in Catalonia to fight with the nationalists in Catalonia, and that there nearly was a civil war over this. And this was partly, you know, they say like in America during the election that the Russian internet trolls would try to bring different groups together, like make two groups in the same city in America go to the park and have an event at the same day where they knew that those two groups would start fighting with each other, something like this.
Right.
That this is what they were doing in Catalonia as well. They were playing the two sides in the separatist issue in Catalonia, and that this was partly a revenge to get back at Spain for having prosecuted certain people.
It's interesting because as you're talking about this, I'm thinking in my head, there's a fine line, especially with this mob. If they're dealing in just weapons, I'm not talking about the drugs, but just weapons, there's a fine line between weapons violations and weapons dealers. You know what I'm talking about? Was there any, and I'm not familiar with the trial, so forgive me on this, but was there any attempt by them to say that they were potentially sanctioned dealers for the government, or did they not even take that stance?
Well, this is a mystery with a lot of things that go on. I mean, the suspicion which has come up again and again, I mean, also with an unrelated case, which was a weapons dealer named Victor Bout, who was in Africa, but he was with the Russian military, and he became a rogue weapons dealer after the Soviet Union broke up. Is that Russia actually wants to supply weapons to a lot of rogue warlords, let's say, in different countries. Mm-hmm. And they don't do this overtly. So it's not like the Russian government directly contacts whoever they want to sell the weapons to, but rather they cooperate with organized crime to sell the weapons. And not only that, is also to do the money laundering associated with the weapons deals. I mean, how to pay them or how to receive money. I mean, these sorts of things are done in such a way that the Russian government can claim not to have been involved, because they can claim that this was an independent organized crime group that did this.
Now, I want to kind of run it back a little bit here. In that, now, Russia could claim, at least in front of NATO and the world and world courts, couldn't they just claim, and follow me if you will, that Latvia is a not only a neighboring country, but a friendly country, and in that, they possibly couldn't be governed in that they were doing business transactions as an agent of the state? Involving these, I know, it's a little far-fetched.
It gets quite twisted. Okay, to test your memory of Russian mafia money laundering, mm-hmm. there is a similar case, in my opinion, was the Bank of New York in the 1990s mm-hmm. was caught running a huge money laundering racket that was associated with a Russian who's one of the top wanted by the FBI named Semyon Mogilevich.
Okay.
So it was Bank of New York and Semyon Mogilevich were running this huge money laundering racket. I mean, it was run through Bank of New York, but that doesn't mean the senior people at Bank of New York knew about it. But anyway, when the story of this broke, the Russian government announced that, oh, what a terrible institution Bank of New York is, that we're going to sue them for billions of dollars because of this money laundering that went through the bank. And they're all crooks and so forth. But at the same time they're doing this, Mogilevich moved back to Moscow and settled down, and he just lives there. So you wonder, like, how serious are they? Are they fighting against this money laundering? If the guy who orchestrated it is living in Moscow and they can arrest him any day they want to, and they choose not to, but at the same time, they're blaming Bank of New York for everything. So this is something of how these things get set up. They set up to blame somebody else. So like if something is discovered to have happened in Latvia, for example, that it's Latvia's fault. There was another one related together with this, which was a Danish bank. And this Danish bank was suddenly blamed for this huge money laundering that went on through the Danish bank. Now, I don't think that that was set up by the executives at the Danish bank. I think that the Russians put a cell of people into the Danish bank who ran all the money through. And then to blame Denmark for it afterward was absurd. It's sort of like blaming Bank of New York for everything that happened at Bank of New York, even though I think the executives did not necessarily do that. But the thing is when the top guys who orchestrate it then can go to Moscow and hang around and, you know, have a party, celebrate how they duped the West afterward, this is something to take notice of. I mean, obviously they're not serious about cutting down, fighting this money laundering. If they're then welcoming all the crooks to Moscow to celebrate their thefts afterward.
Well, that then leads to this question. Were there people at your bank there in Latvia that ended up somehow, as this is going on, getting a, well, I know I'm kind of jumping to the end of the story here, but were there people that eventually got a pass and went back to Moscow?
Well, there are certain people who were involved with my bank who also got listed on the United States Treasury has a sanctions list. It also has another list, which they refer to as the Putin list, which is a list of people who the U.S. Treasury knows are closely associated with Vladimir Putin. And this Putin list or Putin warning list is sort of a list of people who might get sanctioned in the future. It's kind of like, for example, right now, if Russia will invade Ukraine, quite likely the United States Treasury will say, okay, everybody on the warning list, now they're not just a warning, but now they are sanctioned. So several of the people involved were on that list. So they're, according to the U.S. Treasury, they are part of the inner circle of the Kremlin.
So this leads me to another question, in that if a tiny country, and Latvia is relatively tiny, if they're one of the countries that Russia's running out of, are you aware of other countries that they're running these schemes out of, or is every country fair game?
Well, I think they try to move these things around. It's partly the countries where the banks are located. It's also partly the countries where they register the shell companies to hold the bank accounts. And through the past 30 years, they have been, there's a lot of money flowing around in these accounts. So they don't only need one country. They need several countries to run the money through. And there are several countries where they run the money through the banks. And there's also several countries where they set up the shell deposits, shell companies, I should say, including at times there have been states in the United States where they've set up the shell companies. To set up the shell companies, they need to find a jurisdiction which meets their criteria where they can set up all these companies and nobody knows who owns them. And regarding the banking system, then you need to find someplace which has credibility so you can run money through there without it being a complete joke, because there are some countries where if a transfer came from there, you just like wouldn't even accept it. But at the same time, they have to control the country, but at the same time, kind of dupe the West that the country is clean. The whole thing, in my opinion, I mean, with my co-author as well, I mean, we agreed and we were introduced by mutual friends. When I met William Burton McCormick, my co-author, I told him, like, listen, you're not going to believe this story. And he lived for a while in Latvia and Ukraine and was had some familiarity with it. But he's a professional writer. He's not a banker. But anyway, I said this has many wonderful elements to it. It has elements of, okay. So anyway, I said that, listen, this has many great elements that could be a story. And part of what can be a story is that there was a cover-up as well. So first of all, there's a personal story. There's me getting duped to be the front or one of the fronts for this organization. Mm-hmm. Then there's all the criminal stuff that went on in the organization. And then there's this whistleblowing. And then there's a cover-up. Mm-hmm. Now, the cover-up in some ways is still continuing and in other ways is exposed, because it is exposed in the sense that in certain media sources, you can read the evidence that it has been exposed as a cover-up, although in the official media in Latvia, it is not exposed as a cover-up. But anyway, there were all these different aspects to it that we felt made a really great story.
Okay, and John, before we get to the cover-up, I do want to get to the whistleblowing part, because this is the part on your story. And we will get to, in the second half of this program, folks, we will talk about the book, which is wonderfully written by William Burton McCormick and John Christmas, which is KGB Banker. We do have a link to that book in the description of this show. In today's show, and I want you to go ahead and click on that and go ahead and get the book. The actual whistleblowing itself. Now, I do want to, again, run it back. I want to talk a little bit about first, before we talk about the actual whistleblowing here, about some of the acts that were committed within the bank that tipped you off that this bank is compromised. You mentioned the loan to the one criminal.
Well, it wasn't just one loan. There were multiple loans to multiple criminals.
Okay. So that on itself is suspicious. But what is the one thing that absolutely gets you, or maybe it's more than one thing, that absolutely gets you over the top, and you know that this bank is a money laundering operation, that it isn't exactly above board?
Well, there's two aspects to it. I mean, one aspect is the money laundering and the other aspect is the embezzlement. Now, it's another funny thing about organized crime, which is hard to comprehend, and it's been in other tales of other corrupt banks as well, that they'll do two things at the same time. They're accepting deposits from criminals, which they know is dirty money, mm-hmm. and transferring it around for bribes or payoffs or whatever they're transferring it around for. They're doing that. And at the same time, they're also, in a sense, stealing the money because they're making loans to themselves. So it's sort of the banks, the criminals within the bank are stealing the money from the depositors, in the sense that at the end of this, there's going to be some depositors who are not going to get the money back. Okay. There have been, amazing cases of this, like the bank for Pablo Escobar in Colombia was not only accepting his deposits, but was also stealing the money from him by making loans to themselves. Now, you could say, how could any person be like so insane that they would do something like this? But that's exactly what they did. I mean, in the case of my bank, not only they were Russian mafia and they were handling money for the Russian mafia, they also embezzled the money. But then because of this cover up, the money wound up getting refunded to them because they got bailed out by taxpayers. So that's the funny thing. I mean, if the taxpayers didn't get involved and didn't bail it out, it would have been one faction of the mafia stealing from another faction of the mafia, and I guess they would have settled it in their own way. But the fact that taxpayers got involved and bailed it out was the really crazy part to me.
Yeah, that's kind of a double dip there. I mean, it also sets up more funds, when the government puts it back in.
But anyway, that is the two aspects to it. So one aspect is the money laundering. Most of the deposits at the bank were shell company deposits. They were not people's names on the accounts. They were shell companies held the accounts. So that was money laundering. But my whistleblowing was focused more on the embezzlement side of it, which was making loans to related parties and to book the loans fraudulently. So when you looked at the balance sheet of the bank, if you looked at the assets, the loans, many of them were fake assets.
Okay. So you get to a point now where the evidence is pretty overwhelming. You know what you're in and you know what you're in too. You've got to turn somewhere, and you've been documenting all of this, but you've got to turn it over to someone somewhere. Where do you go?
Well, I went to a series of places, and how this played out was not anything like I anticipated at all. Starting with the auditor and then to the ratings agencies and then to departments of the Latvian government, departments of the UK government, departments of the US government, even to a few other governments, Germany, Sweden, Switzerland, all of them were in some way involved. Even the Russian government, I even gave information to the Russian government. I mean, how much this mafia is, I mean, it's a mystery how the Russian government works. Maybe there are some people in there who are actually against corruption, and maybe depending whose desk this would land on, there would be some kind of result. But it's amazing the contradiction between the words you hear from all these regulators about how they're all fighting so hard against corruption and money laundering and so forth and fraud, to then give them all the information. And the reply back you get, which is most of them are angry that you gave them the information, or they refuse to admit at all that you gave anything to them. They won't look at it. They deny everything. And that's the experience I had. I just gave the information to a lot of different parties, and everybody wound up either ignoring me completely, or else to my feedback was that they were angry at me for giving them the information.
I'm curious as to who gave you the harshest response out of everyone that you went to.
Well, I can say this is spy stuff that you're going to enjoy. So when I actually worked at the bank, I was sometimes invited to lunch by the commercial attaché from the United States Embassy.
Okay.
I was also sometimes invited to lunch by the commercial attaché from the Russian Embassy, who also more or less became my friend.
Okay.
So both of them told me that that they were very concerned at things going on within my bank, and it seemed like they were fishing for information, that if I would tell them something about what's going on inside my bank, that they would be very interested in this. So when I did this whistleblowing, I gave both of them the information. There was no result from the United States Embassy. They pretended like they didn't receive the information and refused to confirm or deny or that they even knew who I was. With the Russian commercial attaché, there was a response, which is that the Latvian government declared him a person non grata in Latvia and kicked him out and sent him back to Russia again.
Huh.
So it's sort of like they confirmed that he was a spy, but I mean, I actually liked that guy. I thought he was an honest guy, and I thought, you know, he's within the Russian government, but he seemed like he wanted to uncover the organized crime stuff. And what the Latvian government should have done is they should have, exposed this bank fraud and prosecuted everybody, but that's not what they did. What they did is they kicked out that one guy from the Russian embassy, kicked him out of the country. He still is my friend on Facebook, by the way.
Well, I mean, that's good. I mean, it, you know, unfortunate circumstances aside, I didn't mean to say circumcised, which he might have faced when he went back, which could have been a horrible, horrible penalty. I'm also curious, too, when you bring it to countries like Great Britain, do they care?
The British were the worst. I couldn't believe it. I went to the financial regulator. In fact, I went to three places, the Serious Fraud Office. I even went to the Treasury Committee in the Parliament. None of them did anything. I did have a face-to-face meeting with the financial regulator, and I was telling them about this is actually... There were different stages of this. This is at the point where I already blew the whistle in Latvia. I already ran away. I was in London. The bank had not publicly collapsed yet. I mean, it did publicly collapse later, but at that time it had not yet. It was trying to issue bonds and list them on the London Stock Exchange. And I told the British regulator, I said, listen, this bank is completely criminal. And I gave all this information to the government and the government's not doing anything, which indicates to me that the government is completely corrupt. And, you know, they're trying to borrow a lot of money in London and you probably shouldn't let them. And their reply back to me is that I was not the first whistleblower who approached them about this bank. I said, oh, so you already know about this bank before. And I said, well, since I'm not the first whistleblower who approached you about this bank, why don't you stop them from listing bonds on the London Stock Exchange? And still they did nothing. And those bonds were listed on the London Stock Exchange. All the money disappeared and taxpayers had to bail it all out.
Wow. That's I don't get why you would do that. I mean, you would think you would want to save some people some heartache and some cash.
Well, the entire behavior of the British throughout the entire last 30 years since the Soviet Union supposedly wound up has been mind-boggling to me, because it seems that, you know, a lot of the money winds up there and a lot of the crooks wind up there. And I don't see how it's in their self-interest. I mean, there are theories that the British government does this to help the real estate agents, because, you know, the real estate agents in London who want to sell an apartment for £100 million, they can't sell it to any normal person. So they only can sell it if a top organized crime boss from Russia will come there and buy it. But to say that the entire country should jeopardize its security in order to help the real estate London's agents sell expensive flats in London doesn't really make a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, it makes no sense at all. So you've made your appeal to governments, you've made your appeal to auditors, you've made your appeal to everyone you can. Who steps forward and says, you know what, John, you're right, you got a case here, and we're going to step in and we're going to do something?
Well, so far, nobody has done anything. I mean, the book, there is a resolution to how everything plays out in the book.
Okay.
But that's fiction. In the real story, it's still sort of pending what's going to happen, because there have been several banks that have collapsed already, including the first one, which is where I was employed, and several successor banks to it. But they keep moving on to new banks. So each time one bank collapses, all the gangsters move to a different bank, and they're still all in business. So from what I understand, the money laundering is still continuing on just as it was before. If anything's going to change in the situation, well, now it seems they're getting close to having a war in that region. And maybe suddenly now, finally, there's going to be some fighting between the oligarchs, for example. Maybe within Putin's government, maybe one faction is going to start fighting a different faction. Maybe something's going to happen to break up the monolithic power structure they have right now. But I mean, so far, there's actually not been a resolution. And like I said, in the book, there is a resolution, which I would like to see happen sometime, but that has not actually happened in the real story.
Well, I've got to ask you, John, I mean, you and I are sitting here talking right now, and obviously you had to get the hell out of there. I mean, something had happened, and we're not going to disclose anything about where John is or where he fled to, but you had to get out of there physically, somehow out of Latvia. Did somebody help you get out? Did you just have the good common sense to say, I'm out of here, and you went out the back door? Or how did you get away from what obviously was a KGB mafia press on the bank?
Well, my real escape was as simple as I just bought an airplane ticket and I left, and I haven't gone back there again. But I mean, in the book, we make it more exciting than that. But what I did in the real story is I just bought an airplane ticket and I just left.
Oh, that's a darn fine escape. I have to ask you this question too, because we've seen the story, whether you watch 60 Minutes or whether you watch any of the news organizations' dealings with Vladimir Putin and what he does with former spies, such as, you know, radiation poisoning or any of the other fun stuff that they've developed over at the KGB. When you see stories like that, does it concern you, or do you feel like you're pretty low on the totem pole when it comes to spy revenge or anything like that, or even Havana syndrome?
Well, I do think about these. I have read about all of those things. And, you know, I am always kind of paranoid. For example, if I meet a new person on the internet who I don't know who that person is, and that person maybe wants to meet me for coffee, should I actually meet that person? Or maybe it's better not to tell that person where I am. But what I would like to hope is that the KGB or the mafia or the FSB or whatever you want to call them today, they're very vengeful toward their own employees who turn against them. And I'm not in that category, because I was never, I never signed up to be in the KGB. I was just used as a front person. And then I discovered they were using me, and then I spilled all this information. But those guys who got the worst, got poisoned, the spies who actually got poisoned and killed in terrible ways, Those guys were with the KGB. They were agents themselves, and then they became traitors, you could say. I mean, that is, if you think the KGB acts in the interests of the Russian people, then in that sense, they would be traitors by acting against the KGB. So those are the people who they seem to be harshest on is their own people who turn against them. And I'm not in that category. I'm not Russian.
There's a brand new book out there. It's a true crime fiction book out there, and you're going to want to pick it up. There's a description of it in the there's a link for it in the description of our show. It's called KGB Banker. It's written by William Burton McCormick and John Christmas, our guest here today. We're going to talk now in this segment of the program about a crime fiction book out there that is co-written with him and William Burton McCormick. It's out now. It's called KGB Banker, and it is based on the true experience that we've been talking with John about in the first part of the program. And it's quite the thriller, John. As we mentioned, it's based on the experience that we were just talking about. And start us off by telling me a little bit about how you came across meeting William and how the book was first formed, how you decided you wanted to take your real life experience and turn it into a book.
Well, it became the project came about because of an introduction where I had a friend who a Canadian who was living in Latvia, and he had a friend who was this American author who was temporarily in Latvia, although actually lives in Ukraine. And our mutual friend said, you guys need to meet each other, because William had just released his first full length novel, which was a historical fiction about Latvia and Russia. And it was an excellent book, very well received by audiences, published in English and in Latvian. And he was interested in material for, you know, his next full length book. And I said, I've got a story which is dynamite and you won't even believe it. And it's even true. And we can use this as a basis to make a thriller. Bill was not interested in writing a nonfiction book. It's not his thing. He's trained as a fiction writer. So he wanted to write a novel. So we met up. We went to the Latvian house in London. There's a affordable B&B in London, which they refer to as the Latvian London house, where we spent a week together brainstorming and coming up with characters and plot and deciding how this could be made into a super thriller where we have all the elements in there. There is a main character who's based on me. Nobody else in the book is officially based on anybody. So people who are in the book, there are incidents in the book which were related to real things that actually happened, but there's not any character in the book who is designed off of someone in reality, except for the one who's designed off of me. So there were certain incidents that when Bill and I were talking about all my experiences, there were certain things that he thought, aha, that's like a really good one. We have to put that in somewhere. Or that's a really good one. We have to put that in somewhere. And I think what he came up with was dynamite. I mean, he had all these ideas about how to design the characters and the suspense to make people relate to the characters, make people have feelings about the characters. Also, how to design the suspense when various things happen throughout the book to make it exciting. I think he did a really great job. We were working together on this the whole way to also, for me, because there was a elements of the true story that I really wanted to get in there, like not just the whistleblowing, but the cover up of the whistleblowing, which is in the book roughly similar to how the real cover up worked.
Interesting. So let me ask you this, John. As you're going through this with William and the two of you are sitting down and writing, do you feel that it was somewhat cathartic? Do you feel like a certain amount of stress was lifted off your shoulders as you're going through and getting this off your chest?
Well, yeah, the something that I feel better about is just having the real story into the media, because there's been so much disinformation that has come out since the time of the collapse of that bank. Nobody knows what to believe. I mean, in Latvia, the media does not say at all what the true story was. I mean, if I would go to Latvia and tell someone, oh yeah, I was the whistleblower when this bank collapsed because of making loans to related parties, they'd say, I never heard that story. They'd say that they never heard that that's why the bank collapsed, and they never heard that there was a whistleblower, that that's not what the media says. The media says that the bank collapsed. They've had different excuses they've come up with over the years, like because of Lehman Brothers. And I'll say,
really?
I'll say, well, the bank did not collapse because of Lehman Brothers. Lehman Brothers had absolutely nothing to do with the collapse of this bank. And they'll say, well, that's what I heard. Or somebody else. I mean, there were a lot of stories that Sweden caused the bank to collapse, that it was somehow Sweden put corrupt pressure on the Latvian government to ruin this bank because it was competing with the Swedish bank. I said, no, this has nothing to do with Sweden either. But the level of disinformation and lies and fake information in the media there is mind-boggling. But what I wanted to do, and this is a fictional book, but the interesting thing is that it's more close to the truth than what has actually in the media in Latvia.
And there, well, I take it, of course, they don't have a free press over there in Latvia, but there was no level of investigation whatsoever. It was just basically whatever the Latvian government was putting out for them to spit back out at the people then.
Well, officially, Latvia is supposed to have a free media. Latvia got accepted into the European Union as a member state, and it's one of the qualifications you need to have a free media in order to get into the European Union. That's one of the rules. Now, Latvia does not, but they claim that they do, and somehow they've duped Brussels with this. I mean, another thing as well, that Latvia claims that they love whistleblowers. They have this whistleblower protection law. They say that they welcome all whistleblowers, that they want to reward the whistleblowers. Well, I'll tell you, I did a whistleblowing, and I got chased out of there with threats, and what the reaction of the government was nothing like what the words you hear from the government are. But they are supposed to have a free media. They're supposed to reward whistleblowers. They do not. And somehow Washington has not really woken up to this. And Brussels also has not really woken up to this.
When you say you were chased out of there with threats, was it threats locally from Latvia, from Latvian officials?
Well, a funny thing about the threats is generally threats come from people who are actually my friends who claim that they're trying to help me. Like, for example, former colleagues who would say, listen, John, I really like you and I really hate the guys who run this bank, but I'll tell you, they're going to come after you and get you in. You know, you better like leave the country. There was one in particular that was the most scary. It was more than just a threat. It was that I was informed that someone from the bank was trying to figure out if I had a car and where my car was.
Ew.
So I thought, well, this is no good. I mean, I didn't actually have a car,
right.
Luckily, but that was one of these things where, you know, I got the airplane ticket and I left the country and I didn't go back again. But, you know, the way I was informed of this was that it was like my friend was telling me that, you know, my former colleague from the bank who was my friend was telling me, listen, it's really, really bad people at the top of the bank. And they're looking for your car now. I know that because they called me and they asked me, like, what is your car and where is it? And I said, well, thank you for the information. And I guess I'm going to get out of here now.
I don't blame you. Yeah, when someone just basically straight up tells you that, you know, you're on the list, you quickly exit so that you don't find out what is all involved in that list. With the book, and again, folks, the description is in the the link is in the description of the program. It's called KGB Banker, and it's written by William Burton McCormick and our guest John Christmas. With the book, obviously, there's some things that are thrown in the book that don't happen to you in real life. I'm curious as to in the story, there's got to be a point where the hero, which obviously is you in a different character, is going to take a turn or a more heroic turn and figure out a way to confront the villain in the story. Who is our villain in this story? And is it the mafia directly? Is it, can you tell us a little bit about the villain in the story?
Well, there's a lot of, bad characters in the story for sure. I mean, there's the protagonist gets attacked or betrayed, however you want to say it, by many characters. So it's hard to isolate it down just to like one bad character.
Okay.
But we were talking about, yeah, what to do with the, I mean, there was a point where the main character who worked at the bank decided to become a whistleblower. There was also a later point in the book where he decides he needs to get out of Latvia. There also is the villain who is this, there's a shadowy puppet master in Moscow who is the villain, but he operates through various people who are in Eastern Europe, who are his people who you actually meet, because you never actually meet the shadowy guy in Moscow. You meet some other people, but we were discussing which countries to focus on, and the countries we focused on, well, the actual story mostly was in Latvia, so it's in Latvia partly, but we included also Estonia, Lithuania, Ukraine, Moldova. These are all countries that Bill and I are both attached to, and we've both traveled widely throughout the entire region and lived in various places in these countries. So we wanted to highlight these countries. And as the character, or not just the main character, but sometimes with one of the other characters, we visit each of those countries. And in each of those countries, I think Bill did a great job bringing the scenery to life, where he really kind of captured something going on there, not necessarily just the main tourist site in each town, but he really captured something in each country, I think, where anybody who's familiar with Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Ukraine, Moldova, they will enjoy this because they'll find something in this for them.
Also, I'm kind of reading through a description here. There's the one employee, elderly employee that you can seem to trust. There's a crazy reporter involved in this as well. It seems like there's plenty of obstacles involved with our hero as well, trying to get through and a little bit of help trying to get through the obstacles and the villains in his way.
Sure. And we had different motivations for different people. For example, there's some people turn for the better and some people turn for the worse in the course of the book. I think Bill did this really well where, you know, people are under a lot of pressure in the book, not just the protagonist, but the other characters as well, and how he handled the human side of them, of people, certain people making decisions to do certain things. I love that. You know, a lot of the thematic content of it is about the importance of journalism and free media. So one of the important characters is the journalist with integrity. There's a journalist with integrity and there's a journalist without integrity in the story. And there's also a news service, which is similar to what the real world WikiLeaks is.
Okay.
So we have a fictional version of that, but that also, there's some culmination of things that occurs in the country of Iceland, which is actually not a place where the real story took place. But anyway, it's a fascinating story. And Bill is familiar with Iceland, so that's one of the reasons it appeared there. But also because Iceland is one of the countries that is very much pro-transparency and supports these kinds of initiatives. Like when people get kicked out of other countries, then Iceland welcomes them to come to Iceland. So anyway, we have this interesting scene in Iceland, but also it's important just thematically that we wanted to have something about journalism and the importance of journalism and the importance of free media in there. And that was that aspect of the book.
I'm glad you tackled that. You know, I think, and I can feel eye rolls as I say this, but I think it's important to actually address that. I think the media has gotten a bad rap over the last, I'd say, decade, maybe even decade and a half. There is still respectable journalism out there, and there is still journalists that check three sources before they go to publish something, and there is still reliable journalism out there. And I think there is reliable free press out there that does report the news as it is. There is also journalism where it's gonzo journalism, where the thing that they're doing is either trying to report sources that are biased or just trying to be the first on the air to get something on and they're not reporting accurately. And I think you did a wonderful job of representing both. And I applaud you for that. And William as well. You know, it's really tough to go into this world knowing what to believe and who to watch. I get asked that a lot. Tim, who do you watch as far as news, and who do you believe? And there's a website, and I don't have it in front of me right now, where you can, it's like a mediacheck.com or something like, I don't remember. And I should try and find it out and put it in the description of this show as to who you can believe, which way it leans, and whether they're accurate.
Well, for sure, a theme that we discussed, I mean, with Bill, explaining the true story to him, there's so many villains and so many people who should have acted who refused to act or failed to act, that is very hard to find who is going to be the hero who's going to resolve all of this at the end.
Yeah.
And the decision we came to, that it's going to be about journalism and it's going to be about free media.
Right.
So that's how the story is going to get out. We're not going to have it be like the government regulator is going to get this first. We're going to have it be that the journalists and the free media are going to be, that this is the solution to the problem, to blast it out all over the internet so everybody knows what's going on.
Well, and that's important too, because it is a free media. And I think that's what people don't keep in mind, is that a free media is going to break a lot of stories that governments are never going to give you. Governments are going to, for good, let's look at the good and the bad. The good is that governments do keep secrets because there are some things that do need to be kept secret. The bad is if you do have corrupt government officials, there are going to be some bad things that are going to be held from you that do need to come to the light of day. And a free press will report the things that need to be reported on. And they're the champion of the people, put it that way.
Well, sure. And there is a lot of controversy about this. And it's something that makes it great for a book, you know, because you can come down on either side of that, or you could say that, oh, but what about this? Or, but what about this? And you can, debate what the role of the press exactly should be, or what the role of government should be, or what should the press, is there anything that the press should not be able to talk about? I mean, these sorts of things.
Sure.
This is in the book.
Yep. And that's good. And you know, like I said, our listeners should look forward to reading the book. Even if it's just for that alone, I think it's always good to have a healthy debate on any topic, whether you are a fan of the free press or you have issues with it. I think it's good to even peruse it just for that. I mean, any discussion is a good discussion, especially if you can keep your wits about you and keep it a healthy discussion and be able to look at things point counterpoint, you know?
Well, sure. That's where I think there's a lot of groups targeted by this book. If you're interested in spies, if you're interested in Russia, if you're interested in Eastern Europe, if you're interested in financial shenanigans, if you're interested in free press issues, and also the fact that the book takes place right at the center of where current events are today. I mean, it's, yep, it's this conflict with Russia on one side and the countries of Eastern Europe on the other side. That's where the news is right now. And that's where our book is. And Bill even lives there. I mean, he lives in Ukraine near to Russia. So we have all this wound up with themes and with characters and suspense. I think that together with Bill, we've really created a dynamite product.
Well, we're looking forward to reading it here, John, definitely. The book is KGB Banker. It's written with William Burton McCormick and John Christmas. And John, give our regards to Bill. I know he's living in a very hot spot as far as the world goes right now. And let him know our thoughts and prayers are with him, that everything wraps up peacefully in that area of the country, and that things are good for him there.
Thank you, Tim. I'm sure he'll appreciate that. I'll pass on the message.
Sounds good. Folks, at this time, if you are a premium subscriber of True Crime Tuesday, it's time now for Drunk Crimes and Stupid Criminals.
It's Crayon News Storytime.
What happened with this dude, Christ Bearer? I heard he cut his penis off and then jumped off a balcony.
Suspect pulls gun from butt, shoots twice at Denver police.
What is your emergency?
Hello, I need help.
And what's the problem?
I'm too high.
You're too high?
Once again, it's that time for Dumb Crimes and Stupid Criminals. And I'll tell you, we'll start it out right away in New York. I know you were going to say Florida, but no, we'll get there eventually. And when we do, it's going to pay off, I guarantee you. Plus, we've got Minnesota Man this time around, and we're getting weird. You know, the deeper we get into winter, the colder it gets here, the weirder we get. I don't know if that's a good thing, a bad thing, or an indifferent thing, but let's start out in New York, where a 73-year-old New York grandmother outsmarted her scammers who pretended to be her grandson and said he needed $8,000 to be bailed out of jail. You know, every time I get that unknown call or that one from a name that I just don't know, I'm starting to become older and older by the minute because I don't pick it up and I let it go straight to voicemail. I've seen one too many specials on Vice. By the way, there is a if you haven't seen it yet, you need to see it. There's a show called Black Market on Vice by I think Michael K. Williams is the host. If you haven't seen it, it's got to be one of the best true crime shows on television. Just mark my words on it. Black Market, Michael K. Williams. It's on Vice TV. I think it's Monday nights. You've absolutely got to see it. It's fantastic. So we continue. A Long Island grandmother outsmarted a group of scammers who wanted $8,000 from her. The woman said a man called her and pretended to be her grandson, claiming he needed that $8,000 for bail money. Now, the woman said she had money at her house and told him to come get it. And then she promptly called the police. Good for her. The woman from Seaford, who asked to be identified as Jean, told CBS2 that she received a call from someone claiming to be her grandson. The man said he was arrested for drunk driving and needed to be bailed out of jail. I knew he was a real scammer. I just knew he wasn't going to scam me, the 73-year-old Jean told CBS2. He started calling me grandma, and then I'm like, I don't have a grandson that drives, so I knew it was a scam. It was probably a good play on her part. The scam took several phone calls to play out and involved multiple unidentified males, police said in a press release. One person claiming to be a lawyer for Jean's grandson told her that he needed $8,000 to get out of jail. A third person claiming to be a bail bondsman coming to collect the money. Boy, you know, it got deeper and deeper at that point, I'll tell you that much. Then officers of the Nassau County Police Department arrested Joshua Estrella Gomez, 28 years old, and charged him with attempted grand larceny in the third degree. He was released on an appearance ticket and is due to appear in court on February 3rd. Jean went on to say, I feel like gotcha, and I feel like you say, so many people fall for this, and you only hear about it on the other end after they've lost $8,000. Nassau County PD spokesperson Richard LeBrun told Insider that people should block unwanted calls and texts to avoid being scammed. If someone calls claiming to have been arrested, call that person or a family member to confirm. Resist the pressure to act immediately, LeBrun said in a statement. Legitimate business will give you time to make payments. Never pay with gift cards or wire money to an unknown person or business, he added. You know, the one thing I'm seeing lately, too, and it's a weird thing. It was actually one of my Facebook friends who put out a status the other day. And it comes to your phone, and I got one on my phone the other day too. And there's a little status that comes up. In fact, I'm just pulling out my phone. Yes, my phone to pull up this message. I don't think I deleted it, but it's an SMS alert, and it has a debit of $220. Tells you when it was made. And it says it was made in an ATM, of all things. I know whether I made a debit and or whether something was put in and where it was put in and why it was put in and why would somebody make a debit in it or a deposit in an ATM. Very weird. And then it says, if you want to confirm that you made the transaction to go with this little bit.ly URL, and go ahead and click on it. Well, obviously, it's a phishing scam. I mean, you know, $220 is such a small amount. I mean, it's not small, but it's small enough that, you know, you would go, oh, yeah, $220. I must have done that. And then you, of course, click on it. Well, that's how they get you. So, yeah, but I had a friend who got the exact same text the exact same day that I got it. And it must have been just one of those things where they hit you from everywhere. Speaking of things I don't like, robots. interesting story from police in Oregon, where police respond to an intruder only to find a robot vacuum cleaner. Yeah, it's true. So I believe this is an audio daily double, believe it or not. Police in Oregon were called after moving shadows were seen behind a locked bathroom door. Let's go to that story now.
911, what is going on?
I think there's an intruder in one of the bathrooms, but okay. The bathroom door is locked. We see a shadow moving around, and the door is closed.
How many people inside the house?
There are two people inside, that's the intruder.
It's a vacuum cleaner.
It is a robot vacuum cleaner.
Hi, copy, it's a robot.
Clear. There's a bad guy.
There you go. He even got wacky sound effects with it. Yep, robot vacuum cleaner in Oregon. Everything is, by the way, okay. Everyone is safe and sound. There's no reason to fret. No reason to get everything in a huff. No reason to call the SWAT team. It's just Skynet, or maybe there is. I don't have anything for that. I don't have like a, you know, special effect. Maybe I should. Maybe I should have a, or maybe there is. I don't have, for some reason, my rim shots aren't working either. We move on, where a Maryland man was found dead in his home, surrounded by over 100 snakes. I don't think that this is necessarily a dumb crime, a stupid criminal, or anything otherwise. But a Maryland man was found dead in his home, surrounded by over 100 venomous and non-venomous snakes, according to officials. Police had responded to the 49-year-old man's home after a neighbor reported that he had saw the man lying on the floor unconscious after he went to check on him after not seeing him for more than a day, according to the Charles County Sheriff's Department. EMS and fire officials forced their way through the front door of the home, where they pronounced the man dead. Police said there was no evidence of foul play, and the man's body was transported to the office of the chief medical examiner in Baltimore for an autopsy. Officials have not yet released the man's identity. Police discovered over 100 snakes of several varieties, just to make your skin crawl a little bit more, inside the home, which the man's neighbors were unaware of. Although if they were, they probably wouldn't have come over for that cookout. Charles County Animal Control was working to rescue the reptiles with experts from North Carolina and Virginia. Jennifer Harris, a spokesperson for Charles County Animal Control, told WUSA9 that the department had tagged and bagged over 125 snakes. Yikes. Harris told the outlet that the neighbors should not be concerned. Oh, no. It's just 125 plus snakes. Go about your business. I do want to assure the community and anybody living in this neighborhood, we have not seen that any of the snakes were not properly secured or could have escaped, she told the outlet. I know people were worried that there could have been some danger to people living nearby, but at this point, we have not uncovered or determined that any of the snakes actually were not secured after this gentleman's death. They just all kind of piled on, killed the guy and had a nap, you know. A 14-foot Burmese python was the biggest snake in the home, in case you were wondering. That, according to Animal Control, I know you guys are probably keeping stats at home. Harris said it was the biggest collection of snakes the county's animal control chief had ever seen in over 30 years of experience. Speaking of animals... And and an animal attacks. This isn't an opposite. This isn't an animal attacking. This is unfortunately a Minnesota man who's a little bit deranged. If you're sensitive to animal abuse, you're probably going to want to fast forward in the file right now. I'll give you a second. And here we go. A Minnesota man charged with killing his roommate's emotional support ferrets told police that he shot the caged animals with a BB gun because, here's the quote, cover your ears, kids, they smell like shit, and claimed that one of the ferrets was laughing at him. Sounds like a great guy. You might want to invite him over for dinner. Police responded Tuesday to a 911 call placed by 57-year-old Maurice Guskey, who reported that his four pet ferrets were missing. Upon arriving at the Duluth apartment, officers noted finding blood drops on the stairs and walls of the entryway. Guskey told police that he shared the residence with 27-year-old Levi Arneberg, or Arneberg, either way, who had threatened to harm one of the ferrets the prior evening. Guskey said Arneberg held a kitchen knife in his hand and said, "It would be bad if one of them were hurt. Get the F out." Oh, wow. Yikes. The roommates had argued because Arneberg claimed Guskey had too much of his personal property in their shared space. According to the complaint, Duluth Police Department officers found the dead ferrets in an alley adjacent to the apartment building. A witness reported seeing Arneberg walking through the alley and saying that a ferret smiled at him, so he shot it 10 times. Boy, oh boy, there isn't a punishment in prison that would be too good for this guy. When cops located Arneberg, he reportedly declared, "Dude, I killed the ferrets. Give me a break." Arneberg, cops reported, said he used a BB gun to kill the animals. Again, quote, "because they smelled like shit." Nice guy. Referring to one of the ferrets, Arneberg said that the big one was hard to kill, and I swear the thing was laughing and breathing, and I just kept shooting it in the effing head. Oh my God. Arneberg was arrested on four misdemeanor animal cruelty counts. You probably could have found more for him, each of which carries a maximum penalty of a year behind bars. He's being held in the St. Louis County Jail in lieu of $20,000 bail. You could probably up that by a couple hundred thousand. And which represents $5,000 each for each deceased ferret, according to a court filing by prosecutors. Two of the late ferrets. I'm looking at a picture of two of the late ferrets, and they're so cute. They're two little cuties, and that's just such a sad story. We'll go to Louisiana, where a Louisiana motorist who led police on a lengthy pursuit before surrendering told cops that he did not initially stop his vehicle because he wanted to eat his burger that he had just purchased. Well, why not? I mean, you know, man gets hungry. A Monroe Police Department officer reported that he tried to pull over a 2006 Chevy Impala that had been traveling with its high beams activated, which made it harder for me to see the roadway when approaching the vehicle, he said. But when the cop activated his lights and siren around 11:10 p.m., the driver of the Impala did not stop. Instead, the vehicle then led officers on a lengthy pursuit, reaching 60 miles an hour in a posted 25-mile-an-hour zone without stopping. After going through approximately six stop signs without making complete stops, driver 37-year-old Alan Seabury pulled up in front of his Monroe home around midnight and exited the vehicle holding a hamburger. Well, that gets one of your hands up. See what I did there? Seabury was handcuffed and then read his rights. He then told police that he couldn't stop due to his brakes being out and because he wanted to eat his burger that he had just purchased. That's a tough decision. You're driving down the road, you got a tasty burger, but your brakes also don't work. Do you want to die before the pure, lovely enjoyment of that burger, or do you just want to crash? I don't know. Seabury was also booked into the local jail on a felony aggravated flight count. He was also charged with three misdemeanors, including driving without a license and driving an uninsured vehicle. Additionally, Seabury was charged with failure to appear in court in connection with a pending 2020 battery case. The arrest report does not further describe the burger to which Steve Berry was so devoted. And it didn't say where it was from. I mean, you know, that's an important deal, too. We talk about another car that was charged in a fatal crash involving autopilot. It's a Tesla, kids. A Tesla driver involved in a fatal wreck in California over 2 years ago while using autopilot has been charged with two counts of vehicular manslaughter. The charges against limousine service driver Kevin George Aziz Riyad, just 27 years old, represents the first felony charges in the U.S. for a deadly crash involving a motorist who was using Tesla's popular partially automated driving system, which will end up being your first arrest if you own a Tesla. I'm just saying. Riyad was allegedly behind the wheel of a Tesla Model S that careened off a freeway in the Los Angeles suburb of Gardena. He blew a red light and struck a Honda Civic in December of 2019. Two occupants in the Civic, Gilberto Alcázar Lopez and Maria Guadalupe Nieves Lopez, were killed. Los Angeles County prosecutors filed the charges against Riyad in October, though they just came to light this past week. Other counts that have been filed in the U.S. involving automated driving systems, but Riyad's charges are the first connected to Tesla's widely used autopilot technology. Autopilot can control steering, speed, and braking. An estimated 765,000 Tesla vehicles in the U.S. are equipped with the technology. Numerous crashes involving autopilot are being investigated by the NHTSA and the National Transportation Safety Board. Since the autopilot crashes began, Tesla has updated the software to try and make it harder for drivers to abuse it. Tesla has warned that the autopilot and a more sophisticated full self-driving system cannot drive themselves, and that drivers must pay attention and be ready to react at any time. Just three more stories left on Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals today. This one, you know, we were talking earlier, I believe it was a week or two ago, about an Italian mafia member, if I believe it was a gangster, who had moved from Italy to Spain and relocated and set up a new life as a shopkeeper, only to be caught and be extradited back to Italy. It turns out this story has a little bit of a different twist. It turns out that German fugitive Norman Volker Franz was spotted on a Caribbean island. The German fugitive is suspected of killing five people and escaped prison twice and has been spotted on a Caribbean island, according to a report. 52-year-old Norman Volker Franz has been on the run since busting out of prison in Portugal in 1999, but cops in Germany believe an eagle-eyed citizen visiting the Caribbean saw the most wanted man while visiting Curaçao. A German tourist saw a man on the island in April who matched Norman Franz's description, North Rhine-Westphalia police said. He knows that he is not allowed to be near Germans. They might recognize him. Interpol authorities put out a red alert last February in an updated request to the public for help in tracking Franz down, saying he should still be considered armed and dangerous decades after his latest escape. Franz has a long history of violent and organized crime, including armed robberies, the International Law Enforcement Agency said in a statement. He was convicted of murder in 1996 after throwing a grenade into a car, which killed two of its occupants. Franz received a life sentence for the slayings, but escaped from a German prison by sawing through the bars of his cell in March of 1997. Franz, who was preparing to start classes at a technical college in Germany at the time of the killings, was part of a gang that targeted banks, smuggled cigarettes, and traded weapons. Franz and three other men lured the victims before tossing a grenade into their vehicle, killing two. He was later arrested at a toll booth while trying to sneak into France with his 23-year-old girlfriend. Franz then allegedly killed three security guards in two shootings in Germany over the next 4 months before he was arrested in October of 1998 for a second time in Portugal. Interpol said Franz had been working in the real estate business at the time while living with his family under the aliases of Karsten Muller and Michael Stuver. Franz proceeded to break out of a prison for a second time by again cutting through the window bars of his cell at a Lisbon prison. He had since been managing to elude authorities across the globe. A reward of more than $36,000 is being offered by Europol for information leading to Franz's arrest, as there is an outstanding warrant of arrest for Norman Volker Franz on suspicion of robbery and murder in five cases. He is the subject of worldwide searches, the agency said in a notice of Europe's most wanted fugitives. Kind of interesting. That seems to be the vogue thing to do now if you're a German on the run, is to, by all means, just pick up and go to another country. Our second to final story today comes from Connecticut, where a Merrill Lynch advisor was fired after a racist tirade against a smoothie shop employee. A Merrill Lynch financial advisor from Connecticut, who was arrested for allegedly throwing a smoothie at a teenage employee, called her an effing immigrant and was fired after footage of that racist rant went viral. 48-year-old James Iannazzo was arrested and charged with a hate crime following the chaotic scene at Robex in Fairfield just before 2:30 p.m. Saturday. The wild encounter erupted when an irate Iannazzo returned to the store after earlier ordering a smoothie that supposedly contained peanuts, which caused his highly allergic son to have a reaction and require hospitalization. A remorseful Iannazzo said Monday in a statement that he was out of my mind with fear for his son and insisted that he told staff about the peanut allergy when he ordered the drink, despite employees telling cops that the father had just asked for no peanut butter. Video taken by one of the workers shows Iannazzo allegedly standing behind the counter repeatedly demanding to know who made the drink. Iannazzo lashes out and calls the staffers effing stupid, effing ignorant high school kids when they couldn't tell him who had made it, according to the footage. He then allegedly called one of the workers an effing bee and hurled the drink at her, striking her shoulder. Iannazzo continued his expletive-ridden outburst before allegedly calling the female employee he struck with the drink an effing immigrant. The video of the ordeal circulating on Twitter has been viewed more than 2.6 million times by early Monday. A spokesman for Merrill Lynch told the Post that Iannazzo, who had been with the wealth management firm since 1995, was fired on Sunday as a result of the incident. Iannazzo's LinkedIn profile lists him as a managing director at the firm. Our company does not tolerate behavior of this kind. We immediately investigated and have taken action. This individual is no longer employed at our firm, a statement said. Iannazzo, who turned himself into cops after the incident, issued a statement Monday saying he made the regrettable comments after his 17-year-old son went into life-threatening anaphylactic shock. After he started to drink his smoothie, my son lost the capacity to breathe properly. His lips and face swelled up, and he required an EpiPen shot, but it did not offer him relief. I called 911, Iannazzo said in the statement. My son then went to the bathroom, threw up, and fell unconscious on the floor. He threw up again. My wife gave him another EpiPen when I called 911 again. Iannazzo said he was out of my mind with fear for him, that's in quotes, when he returned to the smoothie store, saying his actions were wrong and I deeply regret them. They do not reflect my values or my character. I feel terrible that I lost my composure so completely, he went on to say. I wish I had not done so. I also wish they had been more careful preparing my son's beverage. I will be extending my apologies personally to the Robex organization, particularly the staff that was working there that night. Iannazzo added that his son was doing okay after being treated in the hospital. His attorney, Frank J. Riccio, had earlier issued a statement on his behalf saying that Iannazzo's son was rushed via ambulance to the hospital. When faced with a dire situation, Mr. Iannazzo's parental instinct kicked in, and he acted out of anger and fear. He is not a racist and deeply regrets his statement and actions during a moment of extreme emotion, the attorney said. Iannazzo was charged with intimidation based on bigotry or bias, breach of peace, and criminal trespass. Interesting story. You're under extreme duress as a parent, and that's understandable, of course, because your child is potentially dying at that point, but at the same time, that's not the time to be sweet either. you know, but it, there's no excuse in there either for a racist tirade. I don't know. It's a hard line to walk. That's for sure. I don't know what I'd do in that situation either. I wouldn't be racist. I'd tell you that, but it's beyond me. I can't put myself in his shoes. All right, we move on. Our final story. I can't tell you what I wouldn't do. When it's time to leave the kids at home, I wouldn't feed them candy for dinner. I know that much. This woman did, however. A woman went to Florida and left her kids at home. The 36-year-old mom advised her minors just to eat candy for dinner. I mean, she's the perfect mom. Mother of the year material, I say. We go to Connecticut, where a teacher there left her two children at home while she vacationed with her boyfriend in Florida. It's the perfect love story, really. According to investigators, they say the woman told the minors to stay out of sight in the resident's basement and just eat candy for dinner. Oh, she's a peach. She kind of looks like Sandra Oh. I mean, if you've ever watched Killing Eve, she's a spitting image. 36-year-old Carrie Caviesa, I believe it is, was arrested Saturday on reckless endangerment and risk of injury charges in connection with her three-day trip to the Sunshine State in late November. Kaviaska, that's what it is. Kaviaska is free on $5,000 bond in advance of a January 25th Superior Court hearing. Police began investigating Kaviaska after her ex-husband reported that she had left the children, wow, ages 9 and 11, alone in a Watertown residence. 9 and 11. Just eat candy for dinner. Mommy will be back in 3 days. Kaviaska, who has primary custody of the boy and girl, makes you wonder how stable the dad is a middle school teacher, believe it or not, in the Waterbury School District. Oh my gosh. As detailed in an arrest affidavit, Kaviaska's former spouse provided cops with a series of incriminating texts she exchanged with her children while she was out of town. Both of you stay in the basement, wrote Kaviaska, who advised the children to avoid the upstairs of the residence and just stay downstairs. When one child asked, are we going into school? No, right? Kaviaska said no. On a Sunday evening, when one of the children asked, what are we going to have for dinner? Kaviaska answered, just eat candy, I'm sorry. And whatever is downstairs, she added, I'll make it up to you. Oh, mother of the year. Kaviaska cops charge wanted the children to stay out of sight in the basement. When one of the minors asked, can I pee? Kaviaska replied, quick, no lights. Oh, God. After one of the children wrote, I'm sad. I put my batteries upstairs. Kaviaska suggested that the child could go upstairs super fast, but noted, stay low so no one sees you. So evidently this is like some sort of weird wartime situation. I don't know. When police last month, maybe they're being bombed by the Germans. I have no idea. When police last month confronted Kaviaska, she admitted spending a weekend in Florida with her boyfriend, but claimed that her boyfriend, or rather her brother, not her boyfriend, he was with her, claimed her brother had stayed with the children. Both juveniles, however, told cops that they were left home unsupervised, with one of the children saying that only their dog was with them. Well, the dog could fetch the batteries. It might take some training, a day or so, but eventually you could go get them. Kaviaska's son told police that his mother left snacks to eat and that she ordered Uber Eats for the children several times, but they weren't supposed to go up and answer the door. The boy recalled that his mother advised not to go upstairs and to stay in the basement. Because that's what all good kids do when they're being sequestered. Why mommy goes and plays with the boyfriend in Florida. Yippers. Want to thank you once again for being a patron of Stitcher Premium and True Crime Tuesday and getting Dumb Crime Stupid Criminals. Again, you're greatly appreciated. Not only just as a patron of Stitcher Premium, but as a listener, as someone who is intent on the quality of the show and cares about the quality of the show, just know that I appreciate your feedback. I appreciate the fact that quite a few of you are sending in stories. If you have stories that for dumb crime, stupid criminals that you want to send in to me, you can send them in at tim@darknessradio.com. If you have show suggestions or guest suggestions or guest contacts that you want to send me, you can send them to tim@darknessradio.com as well. Have some great guests coming up down the line, and I can't wait to unveil them and get those interviews out to you as well. It's coming up in the next few weeks here on True Crime Tuesday. We'll see you next week. Thanks very much for listening. I'm Tim Dennis, and you've been listening to the best in true crime podcasting. This is True Crime Tuesday.